And this is Application Paranoia episode 13. So welcome again to Application Paranoia, our podcast about application security and AppScan. As always, we try to bring you the best technical insights, assorted facts, and all the things from the world of HCL AppScan. On this week's episode, we're going to talk to Jeff Turnham. So Jeff Turnham used to be our principal architect, and he deserted us for another product at HCL. So we're going to find out a little bit about that later on in the episode. As always, I have Rob Cuddy and Chris Dewar. So welcome, chaps. How are you doing, Rob?
Hey, I'm doing good this week, Colin. Nice to be with you guys, and things are going pretty well here. I think the California wildfires are getting under control, so that's been pretty good. And we're seeing a little bit less smoke and ash in the air, so that's a good thing.
It's always positive. Less smoke and ash in the air is the barometer.
Right. You can breathe again. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So.
How about you, Chris? How are you doing?
I'm great. I mean, it's in New Hampshire, the best state in the nation. Sorry, California. We have peak foliage season. That is a thing. Peak foliage season. Yeah, I said it.
That's when the leaves come off the trees.
Yeah,
then
they turn a pretty, pretty color of, you know, all your browns and oranges and yellows. Me and the missus drove out to a covered bridge. That's all we did. Just drove to a covered bridge and drove home just so she could see the foliage. And my word, the look of joy, sheer joy on her face was worth the price of admission.
Were there any ghosts?
There were no ghosts this time, although we did pass by multiple graveyards that she looked at longingly, but we didn't go into any of them. A little weird. I'm just saying, you can have fun with it.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, that sounds like the opening of a really, really kind of weird short story, though.
Yeah.
We passed by a bunch of cemeteries, and she looked longingly. Like,
we were hoping to find a ghost, and boy, howdy, did we find one, let me tell you.
Oh, man.
Totally believable. But yeah, for those of you in the New Hampshire area, because it's awesome, turns out it's a thing. And we're in the peak. It says the last 2 weeks of October. We're here. It's the time. Get out there and drive nowhere and just walk, look at trees, I guess.
I got to think, if you grew up anywhere from like Maine to Pennsylvania, you know about this, right? Your family would go and visit an area and go up in New England just to look at the leaves. That was an annual trek for us as well, growing up in southern New York. So, yeah, it's absolutely the time.
No, I had no idea there was a peak foliage season. Wow. Like an actual, it's like fall, winter, peak foliage season, summer.
Well, you know, most people take it or leave it. So,
yeah.
You know. Oh, dear.
But I'm pumped.
He's here all episode. Yes.
So sorry.
I did my first race for the year at the weekend.
Wow.
In Waterford, we have a local cancer support group called Solace, and they do a run every October, and everyone wears an orange shirt and goes, you know, it's people walk and run, and it's all raising money for the charity. But this year they decided to do it virtually. So the idea was you pick your own route and you run, and, you know, you just let them know about it. So I took inspiration from our last podcast, and I looked at the map and nice. Managed to trace out the word Solace, S-O-L-A-S.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I ran that, and it was very difficult. It's 24 kilometers, you know.
Now, did you
to get it right?
Did it just happen that way? Because if you get to a certain point, you're like, damn it, now I have to double back.
No. I had to double back a few times, but I also had to run down streets that I don't believe any human being has ever run down before.
Somebody watching you make it, like, you just ran it. Now he's turning around. Oh, there he goes. Oh, he's turning around again.
No. These are streets where you're thinking, oh, this is dodgy. No.
So, word of the wise, don't write Solace, but do write Solace.
Yeah.
But they actually posted it on their website. So, and it's on their Facebook page.
That's
and it's
cool.
Got a lot of hits.
Oh, I that.
So, fame at last, you know. So.
You ran a freaking marathon because it was on his way.
Yeah, just hopefully you spelled it right.
Yeah, I did. Suck,
wasn't it? You get like a tattoo that says "No regrets."
Yeah, that wouldn't be good, would it?
No regrets. Yes. That is a beautiful special.
I have one fun fact that I want to share, and it's fun because it's just funny.
Exactly.
So basically in Ireland has lots of strange rules and things like that, but they decided that that there was a Supreme Court case about Subway. So Subway, the American company that makes subs and whatever. So that's very popular over here. But they've decided that the bread they use can't legally be called bread under the new tax rule. And that's because there's so much sugar in the bread that it has to be considered a confectionery. So there you go. It's not bread. Wrong donut.
Yeah, believe it or not, I actually heard about this here. There was a news blurb on that Subway bread was not really bread.
No, it's confectionery, so there you go.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing. Our court's spending time figuring that out.
Exactly.
I'm guessing it's not good, Chris. Yeah.
We could be spending our, tax dollars on real problems, but no, this is a problem we need to solve now. This is really bread.
Yes. I think they have a similar problem with their chicken, too, though, where some of their chicken is not considered real meat or something like that.
How does that happen?
Yeah. It's like tofurkey. Who knows? Well, that's funny though. The Supreme Court, no less, of Ireland is like, come on, why is court in the country? And they're like, no, we must take up that problem.
That's right.
This is not bread.
Solving the real problems. Doing good work.
At least you can't accuse them of loafing.
Oh my God!
Oh, he really is here all episode.
Well, all right. So my fun fact I thought was really fascinating because we've all done this, right? If you've ever opened a package that came with any of sort of that bubble wrap material, right? We've all popped it and turned it and twisted it because we love to hear the sounds, and little kids love to do this. But did you know that bubble wrap was actually originally invented to be wallpaper?
Is that for people that have a hard time running into walls?
How shit would that be?
Like, I do it every day. I just need something that's padded so I don't hurt myself when I run into my own walls every day.
Yeah. Yep. They were done as like these three-dimensional kind of foam seal air pockets between shower curtains. And so they thought people would like the design and figured that they would go and make it for wallpaper.
I feel like that came out of the shag carpet generation.
Well, it was about 50 years ago, so yeah.
Nailed it.
So, AppScan News, Chris, last time we were on the brink of being able to tell people lots of exciting things, but I think we can actually tell them now.
So. We can indeed. We have released five new languages, support for five new languages, static analyzer.
That's insane.
Static analysis, I should say, which is an insane amount of languages to add in such a short time. Turns out a lot of them were in flight for a little bit, but we finished them off. So we've got ABAP or SAP. For those of you who are familiar with it, it's a pretty big deal out there in the world.
Yeah, it's nice.
It's a huge deal. So there's just an absolute astronomical amount of stuff we look for in ABAP. It might be one of the strongest ones we've ever produced. So good stuff.
It's a phenomenal team that put some of those rules together. So yeah. It was great work.
Yeah. We didn't even build it. We had somebody who was an expert in ABAP and then an expert in security look at the rules and help us figure out what it should all be, because ABAP is, it's a little bit of its own world. So it's really, really cool that cooperation worked out.
Yeah, and that's kind of using the BOYL approach as well, isn't it? Which is great.
Your own language, do all the work for us, and we democratized it, so that's nice. It's a win for everybody, so it works out. Anybody who has SAP now can get their scans done in AppScan on cloud. Which is cool. But yeah, Android, Java, Objective-C, React Native, and Xamarin were all added.
The React Native, I saw, but did we not have React already?
We have React already. React Native is a little different. It's specific to mobile. So there are some things that are specific to mobile environments that we wanted to look for, and React Native sort of encapsulates that. It's like a fancy wrapper, I guess, for React and JavaScript and all that business. So you can write once and run anywhere type of thing, kind of like Vue, kind of like Angular.
And Xamarin's obviously very much in that mobile space, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Microsoft's answer to Android, Java, really, or Scala, or Kotlin, or some of the other languages they decided to use in mobile languages. But yeah, a huge push for mobile to get support in the static world again for some of these languages, which is really good.
Yeah,
I mean, scan your mobile apps. There's no reason not to. There's a lot of stuff in there that we'll look for and find, and a lot of the easy stuff that you shouldn't be doing, we'll take a peek for. So yeah,
well, it's good stuff. More and more stuff happening in mobile. So yes, scan your mobile apps.
Yeah, I mean, it's the new client. It's the new web page, right?
Yes.
People tend to look at it that way and not secure it as much as they should, but now you have the ability to say, "What is under the covers? Let's go take a peek."
What else did we have?
Yeah, no. One of the things that I really like is the new plugins and APIs page. It sort of collects together all of the plugins we've managed to build for the environment over time, and it's quite extensive. I mean, if you look at it, there's, you know, over a dozen different plugins that you can get.
Yeah.
There's certainly the ability for you to bring your own plugin and build it if you want to, which, you know, we like to democratize things, right? Because we're developers, that's what we do.
BYOP.
Well, they call it bring your own integration. Ooh, BYOI, so BYOI.
BYOP.
Not BYOL, BYOI. But yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in here. Vulnerability management, defect tracking system, CICD, IDE, all the stuff that you would normally need to have integrations for to be able to use static, or not even static. Some of it's also dynamic analysis in your environments, whether it be Jenkins or Visual Studio or VS Code, or even, you know, Code Sweep, which is pretty awesome. I think we've talked about that a number of times. Can't talk about it because of how cool it is, and it's free. It's a big selling point. You don't have to pay anything for it. Oh, man.
So the other thing I noticed is that there's a blog out from our chief. Mr. Dave Munson has done a blog. You know, it's well worth looking. So he did a guide, the takeaways from his global CISO talk that he did recently. And it's really quite interesting.
Yeah, I like the number one, think like an attacker. It's almost, you know, like saying the sky is blue, water is wet, think like an attacker. But it's surprising how hard it is to think like a bad actor and say, well, how would I get into this? Well, I wouldn't do any of that because I'm not, you know, mean or nasty. But truth of the matter is, they are, and you need to figure out how they think and what motivates them. I thought that was an interesting theme number one to pull out.
Well, the thinking like an attacker thing, right, that gets right into something we've been talking about on this and a couple of times, and that is getting developers more involved in the threat modeling pieces, right, and thinking through how they can be exploited. And so the more you just involve people in those kinds of things, the safer we all end up at the end of the day.
The one I like is manage your work from home program more effectively. And that really stems from, you know, I guess a position of where we always seem to ask the questions of people, or, you know, how their organizations are doing in these times, you know. And I think HCL really handled that very well. But
yeah,
I don't know that everyone does. Some friends who are in the IT space, and I know that some of them have struggled with connectivities to networks and things like that.
Yeah, so it's a pain in the butt, and it costs time, effort, and energy. It's no good.
Yeah,
and money.
Yeah.
No, but you're right. HCL, shout out to them. They've done a great job with managing that. And you know, shameless plug for us, right? We had Joe on our podcast back in, I think it was episode 3 or 4. And that was where the genesis of that new security employee conversation started. And we may all remember, you know, his kind of famous comment about inverting the flagpole when Chris asked him the question on, you know, where developers stood in that. So lots of great information in there.
So theme 4 was maintain credibility with your development colleagues. I'm assuming that by us having these conversations, we're maintaining credibility with you, Chris. Is that
okay? As the sole development representative. Yes, your credibility.
We haven't let you down.
Hey, development is at least a third as important as the rest of us, right? So,
theme 5 is harness the power of artificial intelligence. So,
what is it? 100-fold return on invest with artificial intelligence if you can get it to work. That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of return on invest if you can get artificial intelligence doing what you need it to do. Like IFA, for example, for us was a huge win.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, so is ICA, which we don't talk about half as much, but it does. I just know from working with AppScan Source for a long time, it's phenomenal what that does.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought I'd share that.
Excellent.
We move on to Chris's best practice. So,
yeah,
Chris,
we're gonna.
You've nearly got your own segment now.
No,
Chris.
This is great. I'm like the weatherman for the show.
Come up with a name for this segment. Yeah.
So, what do you have for us today, Chris?
Today we're going to talk about open source analysis. Woo-hoo. And I think that leads very well into our discussion later with Jeff, I hope. But really, this is just one guy's opinion. But if you do nothing else for security scanning or anything like that, do this. If you do nothing else, I don't suggest you do only this. But if you're going to do nothing, this is better than nothing. Why? You may ask. I'm glad you asked that.
Why, Chris?
Why? Why is that? So attackers are human. They're going to be economic, or as economic as possible. If you write an exploit for an open source package, which is, you know, available, the source code out there, so you can probably figure out a lot faster with that than a commercial product you have to pay for or get somehow some way, the odds of you being able to monetize that exploit skyrocket compared to other places where you have to get the code. So just consider, from the human aspect, thinking like an attacker, if you had $10,000 to invest in an exploit craft, where are you going to put the money? You're probably not going to put it, you know, on Joe's pie shop down the street. You're probably going to put it on one of the more popular open source frameworks that are out there. And in fact, you see a lot of the most recent problems that have happened that have gotten, you know, fancy names like Shellshock and things like that have all been for open source flaws or security flaws that an exploit has been written for and can be used. So if you do nothing else, this is a bare minimum, lowest bar. I get up in the morning, I have my coffee. This is your coffee. Drink your coffee, do open source analysis. But really, we're talking about something that is going to point out to you if there is a known flaw in something you're using, whether it be, you know, a jar or a module that you're importing or wherever the case may be. It's pretty easy. There's, you know, a CVE, a Common Vulnerabilities and Exposure Database out there in the world. There's NVD, the National Vulnerability Database. There's dozens of other vulnerability databases. If you don't want to pay for it, you can do a simple search for whatever package you're using. I would highly recommend not doing that and using instead a vendor that does open source analysis for you, because they're going to be better than you are. That's what they do for a living. And in fact, we offer it on ASOC. So get it, use it. And do the right thing for you and your company. But we
know that at some point in the future, we're going to be enhancing, you know, our capabilities around that as well. Open source is really, really important. Yeah. You know?
It's going to get better. Yeah, no, they're actively developing it right now to get it even better on ASOC, what it can do. It can do now, it's found some stuff for the code that we use that we've had to update. And we're like, oh, we almost sent that out with something really, really bad. That's not a good look for a security tool. Yeah. Let's get that fixed. So really, this is one of those things where, and I can't stress this enough, but usually when it goes on CVD or NVD, it's been 90 days or possibly more where this thing has been in the wild already. So attackers already know about this exploit. You're just finding out about it when it gets reported. So you cannot sit on this stuff. If it's a high and you're using the functionality it specifically calls out, as is most often the case, just update the jar, do the work, whatever it is you have to do to get the newer version or the remediation that it calls out, apply the patch, whatever the case may be, spend the time. You're going to be thankful that you did, because now, instead of an open door on the first floor with, you know, a bright spotlight and music blaring to say, everybody come in here, you've now gotten that particular door closed. You shut the music down, you turn the spotlight off, and you're ready to move on to the next problem, whatever that might happen to be.
And it takes on, and you're right, when we talk to Jeff, I, you know, want to take that a step further and think about, you know, containerized approaches and how that all fits together. So and, we look forward to that.
Yeah, and there are solutions for that too. And it's an interesting world, the containerization, Kubernetes slash orchestration world out there, and certain things that you need to think about too. And certainly open source fits quite highly on that list. I mean, most of the stuff we're writing today, we're not writing all the code. We're literally writing the glue that pulls all this code together. So it's that glue that we scan with our analysis, and we hope that it finds things that we did wrong in terms of how we're using these third-party tools or these third-party APIs. But really, open source analysis is more about if that open or a third-party API or package or whatever it is just fundamentally flawed regardless of how you use it. So no matter what, scan daily. There's no reason not to. And be a champion in your company to get this process started. There's no reason it has to come from the top. It can be started at a grassroots level, just like any other campaign for positive, good change in your company. And to me, it's a bit of a Pascal's wager. For a small invest, you might save millions on the other end just by saying, oh, snap, I have a bad jar that I need to update to version 2 instead of 1. I mean, normally that's pretty seamless. Normally, not every time. I mean, sometimes they have breaking changes and that's just going to have to be dealt with. But really, it's such a small invest for such a high payoff. It just blows my mind that not everybody is doing this on a daily basis for every one of their code bases, no matter how big or small the company is. I mean, this stuff is very approachable now.
Yeah, but it, I think that's starting to change. I think there's a lot more there's a lot more interest in open source for sure. Yeah. You know, we get asked that the questions all the time. So
GitHub,
it's very important.
Has started scanning its GitHub repos now with its own plugin. And that kind of tells you a little bit about how important this third-party analysis is. I mean, you trust it implicitly when it comes from, you know, Apache or Oracle or Java or Node.js, and you do, you know, the NPM update or whatever it is or install. You trust it implicitly, typically. You shouldn't. This is a zero trust environment. Don't trust anything from anybody. Do your checks. The old trust but verify routine. But really appreciate how important this is. It's just so important. When you get notified of it, 90 days, possibly even longer, that an exploit is out there in the wild, it's known about. One person reports it. Odds are that one person isn't the only person who knows about it. So, you know, do the right thing. If you find out about it, fix it as soon as you can. Don't sit on these things.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. Super stuff. In this week's episode, and we're very lucky to have Jeff Turnham. Jeff is currently the principal architect for HCL Software's new Sophie product, something we'll hear more about. He is, however, very familiar to us at AppScan and the application security family from March 2013, I believe, to February 2018. Jeff was our principal architect for AppScan at IBM and later at HCL. And his guidance came the birth of ASOC. So we owe him a fair bit, and we miss having him around. So welcome, Jeff. Thanks for joining us. Where have you been, and what have you been up to since we last had you as part of AppScan?
Yeah, thanks, Colin. This is kind of like coming home, seeing all you guys again and hearing your voices. So basically, my quick history there, you covered some of it. I was at IBM for 20 years. Doing a variety of things, mostly around development tools. When IBM acquired AppScan in, 2007? Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Kind of switched over to that and helped with the development and architecture of it. 3 years ago, came over to HCL, spent a little bit of time on AppScan. But then at that point, Darren, our VP, created two teams. He created what he called a platform team and a solutions team. The platform team's mission was to think about the future of kind of technology and where it's going and try to think about some common problems, some common technology solutions that we're going to try to evolve our portfolio to reach. And so I joined that team as an architect. The other team, the solutions team, was about building new things, new exciting things with HCL software. So yeah, for the last couple of years, it's been kind of a wild ride for me getting up to speed on effectively what we call the cloud native technology. So that's Docker, it's Kubernetes, it's hosting production grade cloud native applications in Kubernetes and places like Google Cloud and others. So yeah, it's been technically very interesting, but I do miss my days on AppScan.
Well, that's good. We miss you as well. So that's not to say things are great, that we're that far apart. I mean, we're all still part of the same family, yep. Which is great. But the other question that I had, in terms of being a principal architect, which I know you are and you were with us, I mean, given that you're in a fairly new team, what considerations have you put in place around application security as part of your development and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I think, I kind of lean on my experience with AppScan and talking to, CISOs and CTOs about their security issues for the last decade. Basically, I try to do what we always told those same stakeholders was security has to be a part of the end-to-end life cycle. So, we've hosted security best practice and coding reviews with the team. We have a lot of relatively junior members on our team. We're hiring up people as fast as we can. A lot of those people are fresh out of school. They're actually well-versed in a lot of the cloud native technologies, but kind of a pervasive problem we've always seen is security is not really taught at school. It's always sort of an afterthought, or it's something that is maybe covered a little bit, but not in any sort of detail. So education is one of the first things we do. And so everyone that comes on the team, we have that discussion. In terms of our own application architecture, we're built on microservices. And so part of my job is to basically think about the threat model as a whole. Each of our individual microservices, we have people focusing on, things like input validation and so on. My job is really to think about the whole picture and think about the attack surface and where we might have weaknesses. One particularly interesting aspect of cloud native applications is the environment that they're running on, namely Kubernetes, usually hosted by some cloud provider or running in your data center, but usually some cloud provider is the easiest way to get going. Misconfigurations or not thinking about security enough in that underlying infrastructure is a huge risk. So part of what we've had to skill up ourselves is understanding how to both secure those environments and monitor them for security issues. And we can talk about more about that maybe in a few minutes. Also, we have different tooling that we institute at different stages of our lifecycle. We use AppScan. We use it for pen testing of our web app. And that's in addition to manual pen testing that we have done by an external team in HCL, which is sort of a obvious best practice. For us, we also focus on automating everything. We have so many moving parts because we have a bunch of microservices, because we deploy to various testing and staging and production environments. The opportunity for manual errors introducing by accident some security vulnerability is huge. And so part of my job is to push the team to always focus on automating everything to avoid all of that manual tweaking or possibility of messing something up. And then we also use tooling to do security monitoring of the running website. So we run Sophie, and I should say Sophie is short for Solution Factory. Maybe we'll talk about that a bit more in a second. But it's a hosted cloud native application that we run in HCL. And so part of that means we need to understand the day-to-day security posture of that application, which means monitoring it for things like intrusions or maybe misconfigurations that are causing something to be open. Perhaps we have a firewall that's not properly protecting an endpoint, things like that. So we have tooling in place to do that. So my job is really kind of to think about the whole application architecture and also represent our security posture to the HCL security team. We have a dedicated team who thinks about security for all of HCL software, and we do regular reviews with them to talk about our architecture and our controls and our mitigation.
Yeah, Chris knows all about that, don't you, Chris?
Yeah. So one thing that always threw me through a loop is weird attack vectors that you never would have considered in the past. For example, when I was looking at Java IO file and constructing just a file object, I'm like, come on, there's no way you can inject command injection through this. Turns out you can. It does no validation to see if it's got the, you know, the command separated characters. And I'm sure there's analogs in Kubernetes/Docker out. But what was something that really took you by surprise and said, huh, that's a thing?
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of them. So basically, one of the first things people have to wrap their heads around when thinking about containers and specifically Kubernetes is it's not like virtual machines. A container is not a whole stack. It's not the whole operating system running on virtualized hardware. It's really a process running on a host is really what a container is. And that's why they start so fast. And that's why they're smaller than VMs typically. And so you really have to concern yourself with how is that process being run? What user is it running at? Even though a container gets its own isolated view of resources and users and processes, so it shouldn't be able to see anything else running on the same host, but there's a class of security vulnerability called container escapes. These usually depend on kernel level problems. But if you can as a malicious user, if you can successfully execute one of these container escapes, you can effectively get full access to the host machine where this is running. Those host machines typically are talking to your backend databases and all kinds of things. So it's a pretty scary type of attack. And there are mitigations for that. You always run your containers with the least privilege and things like that. But yes, there's a whole class of issues. And maybe just in general, something I was really surprised by when I first started looking at Kubernetes was, you know, Kubernetes was built to really run production applications at scale. And it was being used by Google and other teams to run their business effectively. So when I first started looking at this, my assumption was, oh, security is going to be baked in to Kubernetes. In fact, it's not. By default, Kubernetes is actually very insecure. So I think it's a trade-off they made to make Kubernetes really easy to get started with, easy to deploy things as a developer, easy to get started. And then security is something you really have to focus on to lock things down. Like I'll give you one example. We host our own applications and most of our development infrastructure is in Google Cloud. We love it. We use Google Kubernetes environment to run our clusters. By default, if you create a new cluster in GKE, and you deploy a typical Kubernetes application, if it's got a particular endpoint in there, it's called a load balancer Kubernetes service. If you deploy one of those things, by default, you get an external endpoint, external IP address open to the internet. No firewall rule, no nothing, just through the act of deploying that application. So, you know, coming from a corporate and security background, the fact that that was the default behavior was kind of shocking to me.
It's a surprise.
Yeah, and so it's great for development. It's absolutely wonderful to deploy something and have a public endpoint that you can hit and start testing your application. But from a production point of view, it's very, very scary. So we've had to step back and say, what are all the controls we need to put around how things are deployed and how we monitor and make sure those types of things aren't happening in production. So yes, lots of stuff to learn and be surprised about in Kubernetes.
Well, it's something that's sort of really taken off, and we've noticed is the need to be able to scan containers and things like that. It's now a thing, you know, and it's a very important thing, you know. So is it things like that that a good scanner would be looking for, or do you think it goes deeper than that?
Yeah, they're scanning at all kinds of different levels. So we do scanning as part of our development pipelines, obviously, best practice. Some of the things we scan for, in addition to the typical application security vulnerabilities, especially in container land and in microservice land, where the amount of code you're writing is quite small relative to the frameworks and libraries that you're sitting on top of. In those cases, really, the bulk of your vulnerabilities might lie in your dependencies. So we do a lot of dependency scanning to say, you know, version 2.6 of this library we depend on as a publicly disclosed vulnerability, and we need to upgrade to version 2.8 or whatever it is. We couldn't possibly do that manually or keep track of it because we have hundreds of dependencies, even in just one microservice.
Yeah.
So for us, that scanning is critical. And so we take that very seriously. When there's any security vulnerability, we immediately move up to that. Once your containers start moving through your pipeline into staging and production environments, you do different types of scanning. So there you're doing more integration and maybe system level testing of your application. But as I mentioned earlier, a huge attack vector is misconfiguration at the Kubernetes level or at the infrastructure level. Yeah. So there are now lots of benchmarks and tools that you can run to test your Kubernetes configuration. And it'll look at things like how much permission do your service accounts that you're using have? Are they over-permissioned, perhaps? What do your firewall rules look like? You know, and things like that. So we're trying to sit on top of those best practice and those tools that will find those types of things, but it's a moving target. What we're finding is service providers like Google Cloud and Google Kubernetes environment, they're making changes all the time to seemingly get more secure. They're basically changing defaults to get more and more secure over time, which I think is just a natural evolution of the platform, and it's a good thing from our point of view. And so, yeah, it's going to be something that we need to focus on all the time, security end to end.
So, Jeff, what do you say to the folks who will go, hey, you know, containers are immutable and they're ephemeral. So if there's an issue, just make another one, right? And that kind of thing. So how do you balance that kind of mindset against what you're talking about there?
Yeah, that's interesting. So there's a lot to unpack there. So for us on our team, we aren't too concerned with the use case of people running containers kind of manually. You can do that on your laptop or on a VM or something. And that's really useful. And it's a practice you can do on your own in development. It's something we do ourselves. But from a security point of view, we care about stuff in production. And you're usually using some container orchestration technology like Kubernetes to run your containers. In Kubernetes, there actually is no object called a container. The smallest thing is called a pod, which is essentially a wrapper object for one or more containers. And yes, pods are considered ephemeral, meaning at any time, Kubernetes can just decide to kill them if they don't look healthy, or just as part of scaling up or scaling down, pods can come or go. And that's the way it's designed. However, to your question, that doesn't mean that there's less security risk, because these pods or containers are, and unless you're building a stateless microservice, these pods or containers are connecting directly to your databases, or they have file system mounts to persistent disk so that they can keep data over time as they come and go. And obviously pods can make calls to other microservices or maybe even external services. So all of the same application security concerns typically apply to a pod, all the things about input validation and making sure you're doing all the right things from that point of view apply. The one thing that's maybe a little different with pods is that thing I mentioned earlier about you really need to care about the controls you have around the pod and how it's running. Usually a pod runs as a particular user on the host, and it also can run with different service accounts and different permissions in Kubernetes. So for example, you can run a pod that is allowed to go query other Kubernetes resources or not. And so you have to spend a fair bit of time thinking about the minimum amount of permission you want to give to your pods to do it. So yes, to your question, if someone has that mindset that pods, because they're immutable, we don't need to worry so much about security, we can just kill and create a new one. Yeah, I would argue against that, and probably have quite a few examples to share from our own
scandal. Ephemerally badly configured is ephemerally badly configured.
Exactly. So, hey, Jeff, if I can, I wanted to touch on something you mentioned a few minutes ago, because it's kind of a passion of mine, right? We all have heard skills gap in cyber, and you kind of mentioned, right, that when folks are coming in and getting hired, that training out the gate is a big deal. So, we have the opportunity working with a number of different universities and talking about things like guest lecturing and apprenticeships and internships and things like that. What do you think universities and academics can do to better prepare folks to come in and make an impact in these kind of app security roles?
You know? Yeah, that's a really good question. So back when I was at IBM, I did a bunch of similar things working with local universities and trying to talk about roadmaps for technical training and things. I actually think it's a much better scenario today than it was even 10 years or 20 years ago, primarily because a lot of this technology provides a common underpinning for what you're doing. So back in the day, when all of us were coming through school, there was a lot of choice in how things get built and run. You know, I think in my class, we did in my university classes, we were doing C and C++ and odd languages that you've never heard of anymore. And now I think a lot of people are doing Java and other things because there's nice development tools for free like Eclipse that you can use. With Kubernetes specifically and containers even more specifically, I think there's so many patterns, there's so many use cases and helper tools and frameworks now that I really hope educators can focus on building applications and the kind of theory behind that and how it actually gets built and the language you choose. This is almost back to the discussion we had earlier about the amount of code we tend to write in our microservices is quite small. We depend on frameworks, and part of depending on those frameworks effectively is really understanding what they're doing. So if you're relying on a framework to help with user management or to help with database calls or to help with something else, you really need to have a general understanding of application architecture and what's going on there. So yeah, I'm hoping that containers and Kubernetes provides a basic foundation for educating scenarios moving forward so that people can focus on sort of the more abstract concepts. The other reason for maybe focusing not so much on the coding and the language is because this stuff's changing all the time. I've never seen an ecosystem change as fast as the Kubernetes ecosystem. Almost every week, there's a new exciting startup. There's a new framework that helps you with something. And so I think eventually over time, we're gonna see things like Kubernetes and containers drop down in terms of importance. They're just going to become the plumbing that everything else is built on. And we're going to see things like serverless become popular, where people are just writing little snippets of code. They don't really care how it gets run. It somehow goes up to the cloud and executes in a nice, secure container and so on. So yeah, I hope from an education point of view that all of this is goodness, that it's not more confusing to educators and students.
You and me both. You'd love to see good practices, you know, getting into a classroom, right? So as that computer science guy is learning how to write apps and stuff, that they're adopting some of these better practices and considerations and not just, you know, structure of code language and that kind of thing.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's no different than, you know, teaching them proper intention naming and all of the other, you know, good OOP practices, security, I think. And I think you'll find that most people coming out of college, the difference between college level code and enterprise ready production level code, it might as well be, you know, the difference between knowing how to code at all and not knowing anything about coding. I think security falls a little bit in that area, and it's too bad that those basic classes aren't given as part of the, you know, education that colleges are providing, or at least not that I'm seeing for everybody coming out. He's like, yes, I can write an if statement, but can you write proper, you know, encapsulation of an object and properly extended or implemented or whatever the case may be, instead of using said if statement? Stuff like that isn't really being taught.
Yeah, and the thing about security is a shame also, just from a purely from an interest point of view, because as we know, thinking like a malicious user is actually very interesting. It's almost like it's a puzzle, right? You're trying to figure out how to break something or how something might be broken. It's actually from an educational point of view, to me, it's one of the more interesting problems in computer science is how to break a program or get somewhere you're not supposed to be. So yeah, it kind of is a shame it's not talked about more.
So Jeff, you know, we brought you on because we want to hear a little bit more about Sophie as well. So Sophie just got launched, as far as I know, and I'm just wondering, you know, what does someone get with Sophie in this first phase, and how does it all work, and
yep.
And what's the future look like?
Yep. You know? So Sophie, as I said, is short for Solution Factory. Basically, it's part of our cloud native journey in HCL software. So we have a very large portfolio now of enterprise software. All of that software is installed and deployed in different ways today. And so, for example, if you pick one product out of our catalog, maybe it depends on, you know, a certain database, or it depends on certain hardware, or depends on other things. And so part of what we realized a couple of years ago was we see how quickly the cloud native landscape is taking off. So we said we want to start to evolve the HCL software platform to become more cloud native. So Sophie is really the public manifestation of that. So Sophie at its core is a catalog of HCL software that has been made cloud native. So you can browse the catalog. You can kind of see all the things that are available. You can search in there. And when you see some things you're interested in, maybe you see a database or you see a marketing tool or you see something else in there that's of interest, you can basically just click on it and create what we call a solution, which is under the covers, it's using a packaging technology very common in cloud native called Helm. It's basically a collection of Kubernetes configuration that helps you deploy an application easily. But you can easily create one of these things and then either deploy it to our sandbox. We actually have a Kubernetes cluster that we manage where you can quickly deploy things with a few clicks and be up and running in a minute or two to kick the tires. And then when you're happy with it, or you want to take it to your own environment to do maybe more real testing on, or maybe even run it in production, you can download the package from Sophie and go. So really what we're trying to enable, there's two key use cases that we're trying to enable. One is just providing that cloud native form factor for HCL software. So if you're existing HCL user or a new HCL customer, it gives you a way to, and if you're looking at Kubernetes or you're on a cloud native journey, it gives you a way to consume our software that way. So that's use case one. Use case two, which we're hoping to really see some traction on, is if you're trying to build some application and maybe there's a part of the HCL portfolio that would make a good component or a good dependency of that application, we want to make it dirt simple for you to pull that dependency in, just like you would pull in any other open source or third-party dependency into your application. So that's what Sophie provides. We, in addition to full products, we have a section of the catalog that is really microservices that has been built up from extracting kind of key pieces of value from our products and exposing them just as microservices you can pull in and package into your applications. So, you know, some things in there are like different flavors of our 1DB database. You know, we have a document store, which is like a JSON format. We have a REST API store, full SQL relational database stores. And then we have like, you know, 50 or 60 different types of services from across our portfolio. So yeah, we're really trying to enable essentially discovery and consumability of HCL software in cloud native.
So AppScan is not there yet. So how would you envisage AppScan being part of that? How will that manifest?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we are at the moment, we are in what we're calling a soft launch. So all of our products are on essentially a cloud native journey. And at the moment in the Sophie catalog, we have a selection of products that are sort of out there. It's mostly focused around some of our DevOps products, namely
Accelerate. Is out there and Accelerate is out there.
Exactly.
Right? One test is out there. Yeah.
Yep. So yes, we are very eager to get AppScan in there. One of the I'll say blockers at the moment is AppScan does depend a little bit on Windows. And so one thing we're adding right now, and this is something we get through GKE, and we're just starting to experiment with this, is adding Windows-based hosts or nodes to our cluster to run those Windows containers. So as soon as we've proven that out, I think we'll be able to get AppScan into the catalog in a first-class way. And I think there's two ways that can happen. One is if we can think of maybe an end-to-end packaging that works, we can think about a full product. But more interesting to me is the microservice-based approach, where if I want to scan something quickly as part of my DevOps pipeline, maybe there's a little microservice we can wrap and make available in the Sophie catalog or for consumption by an end user. So yes, I'm excited about the future of AppScan and Sophie.
That's awesome.
Excellent.
So with just out of curiosity, right, with Accelerate being part of that, do you see kind of the value stream mapping piece being a big part of what Sophie can provide, and that kind of that visibility as people are pulling things together?
Yeah, we are actually ourselves trying to fully leverage Accelerate in our own pipelines. We want to take advantage of that same capability. So yes, from a Sophie point of view, Accelerate is really just an entry in our catalog. The value stream management, the full automation of your pipeline or visibility into your whole pipeline, that's just a capability provided by Accelerate, and it's not really built into Sophie itself. But over time, yes, we want to evolve Sophie to become something that really helps you build your cloud native applications. And if we can find a way to make Accelerate and Launch and the other parts of the DevOps portfolio integrate in a first class way, then we will absolutely go there.
I did want to know, if you had to pick one best practice for securing your Docker container, just one. I know there's like probably 1,000, but if we had to pick one, the one that you cannot miss, the one you cannot forget about, what would it be and why?
Yeah, like you said, there's too many. But if I had to pick one, I think it would be what we had talked about earlier. It's the dependency scanning, mainly because we're finding that finds the most issues that we actually have to fix. For example, very recently, we had our tooling that we used to do this dependency analysis report that a new vulnerability in a library that's, at the end of the day, this library parses the user agent header in incoming HTTP requests. There was a bug in that it could result in a denial of service if a malicious user created the header in a certain way. And so that library, we don't actually depend on that library ourselves. That's actually several layers deep. We depend on a library, which depends on another library, which eventually depends on this parsing library. And so we would have never found that in a million years, but it was a real exposure because those HTTP requests come in through to our app. They eventually make their way to this library for parsing that header. And so, yes, we're seeing a lot of value from that. And by value, I mean, we have to worry about it every week. What are our and so on. So I'd say it's probably dependency analysis, but with the huge caveat that there's a ton of other things.
Yeah, the other 1,000 things, don't forget about those either.
Right.
Yes. But Jeff, as always, we end up running out of time very quickly on these, but you know, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you. I know we're going to be in touch more because we want to be part of that Sophie journey as well. So hopefully we can get you back on at some point when that happens and talk to you a bit more about it.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you guys again. Thanks for having me.
Yes. No. Hopefully the Leafs will get back on track.
Yep.
But thanks, Jeff. We'll talk to you next time. So that brings us to a blinding end of another podcast. So all that's left to do is to thank you, Rob, and thank you, Chris. And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Don't forget, leaf peeping season is going on.